Well, thank you, Steve, for inviting me here, and I brought my friend Andrew, who spent many years in Jindabyne, so he's in familiar country, and I feel I'm in familiar country. For 10 years of my life, I was a country doctor in northwest New South Wales in the town of Coonabarabran, and I sort of got mentored into country general practice there, and I got mentored into being a community person. That's what I love about country towns. It's all about community. And a little bit of that later. Now, I'll just give you a little... I've got a couple of things to do here. I'm going to give you... If I'm lucky, I'll have my... piece of blank paper. I've got a pen and a piece of blank paper to give you all. How lucky you are. That's an exam, that's right. It's an exam, that's right. Okay. A little bio. Get a pen, pencil, a pen, so you can write. You're going to write some stuff down. That's the idea. All right. So I graduated from medicine and went to Coonabarabran for 10 years, and that's where I became a medical practitioner, really. You don't learn much in university. You learn it all on the job. Well, it's not quite like that, but certainly my experience in Coona was very formative for me. One of the great things we did in the Coona practice was we had a sabbatical leave system. So we were the only doctors in the town. We only needed five, but we had six. And one of us was away all the time. We divided our income into six portions. So when you're away on holidays, you're still earning. And it was a great system. I went away for a year at one stage because we had a six-year cycle. And when I came back, taking my family around the world for a whole year, I had more money in the bank than when I left. Can't be better. I always used to think I'd love to get into another situation like that, but when I came to Canberra, it didn't work out like that. I came to Canberra to get involved with a Christian group called Youth with a Mission and to start their Mercy Ministry arm that continues under the name of Australian Mercy. After 6 years of that, I established my own general practice in Dixon. Oh, it was actually in Downer to start with, and we moved to Dixon. And I was there for... 30 years. It's hard to believe. I feel like it was yesterday. So now I've retired for 18 months and I'm in a project called the National Day of Prayer and Fasting. We have a day in February every year. Coming one's going to be in March to make it a little bit different. On the 2nd. And I would like to ask you if you would be gracious enough or thought yourself free to let me put your names on the mailing list. So that might be a little, you might think after you've heard me, no way. But I'm going to get this handed round, and if you wouldn't mind, we'll promise you that we will use your contact details only with respect to the National Day of Prayer. It will not go to anyone else. So, and I've checked it out with Steve. He said, that's fine. But if you're not happy with that, no worries. Okay. All right. So helping other people in medical practice to achieve their dreams has been a wonderful place for me to learn about life, about community, and about God himself. And my call into medicine happened suddenly. There's nobody in my family who's a doctor other than me, and now my son, which is nice. On Mother's Day in 1964, the 10th of May, was the day I met Jesus. And when I was trying to describe it to somebody afterwards, I said, look, I met the Lord. I thought, you can't say that. That's not, you know, you're not supposed to. And then I thought, hang on, that's exactly what happened. My life was changed. And for the first time, I felt I belonged. I belonged to something bigger than me. I belonged to the heart of the universe. And more than that, I met the Lord who was there with me from that moment on. And I must say I've gone through some fairly heavy things, but I've never felt alone from that day. That was just, somebody said, next to being born, that was the best day of my life. So about almost a year later, I suddenly realized, well, hang on, if I've given my life to Christ, perhaps I better ask him what he wants me to do in my life. I was at school, the last year of school. And so I went up on a mountain, and I was feeling a bit discouraged at the time, and I had one of those sessions that you have to get hold of God. You know, you've got to have it out with him. Anyone been in that situation? Yeah. And it was Easter. I was on this hill looking over Port Stephens. The full moon was coming up. It was a beautiful thing. And I said to God, I don't know why I was feeling so, you know, discouraged, that I said, look, I'm going to give you one more chance. So I opened up the Bible. I don't recommend this. And I put my finger on the page, and I opened up my eyes, and it said, return you backsliding children, and I will heal your backslidings. So that was pretty direct, and so that's what I did. And then I said to the Lord, well, what do you want me to do? And in the next fortnight, every time I opened up the Bible, before I focused on where I was going to go, it just, verses came jumping out of the page. And they were all about healing. They were all about medicine. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? The wound of my people is healed only superficially. Jesus saying, who needs a doctor? Not the healthy, only those who are sick. And after a fortnight, slow message got through to my head, and I said to the Lord, all right, I'm willing to follow you in this way, but you'll have to get me the marks, because I didn't think I could get the marks to get in to medicine. And in those days, it was the last year of the leaving certificate, and it was all contingent upon your marks in that final exam. And I must say that we got the marks. God and me, we got the marks. And I got into medicine, and it's been a tremendous life experience since then. Now, some people tell a joke when they start off their talk, okay? Looking at the age here, I'm sure you've heard all the jokes that are badly termed dad jokes. You know, I don't know who these people are who call them dad jokes, but I'm not going to tell you one, okay? I want to tell you a little story, though, that set the bar for me as to, you know, what is a good, how do you measure a good talk? The story goes that Abraham Lincoln, the President of the United States, went to church with a friend. And the friend came out and said to Lincoln, that was a great sermon. And Lincoln said, how so? He said, well, it was really topical. It was so relevant to all of us. It was really well organized. It was the points were just clear. You know, the illustrations were good. You know, even if I forget the sermon, I'll remember the illustrations. And it was delivered with passion. Lincoln didn't say anything. And the guy said to him, what do you think, Mr. President? He said, I think it was a good speech, but not a great speech. Oh, why? Why was it only a good speech? He said it because it never asked us to do anything great. It never asked us to do anything great. Now, who am I to think that my speech is either going to be good, let alone great? But I hope that today, and the stuff that we talk about, helps us to do something that's great. Even at whatever age we are, we have this challenge to do stuff that's great. Okay? Okay. Now I want you to come with me into my consulting room. Okay? I don't know if you're walking with a walking stick or whatever. You might be young. You've come to my room because your whole life has become confused. We pretty quickly work out that there's no... All right, okay. Well, here's action. There's action happening here, okay. So I quickly work out that you're You don't really have anything physically wrong.
No.
But you're depressed.
Yeah.
You know? And you say to me, I feel lost. Yeah, well, I've actually heard that. In fact, I remember a time when every day for a week someone said to me, I'm lost. In fact, for months there would be someone every day who'd say, I'm lost. So it's very common.
I'll go back.
Well, I can go home. No, you could go back, because then I'd feel like I've done some good.
Okay.
Well, I've done a little great thing today. Cured the first one. So this lostness, very, very common amongst youth. It's very common amongst middle age, you know, early adults, young adults. It's common amongst people of an older age. I won't say our age. I won't say that. And I remember that there's a statement by a chap by the name of Henry Thoreau, who wrote a book called On Golden Ponds. And he said, all men live lives of... Oh, it's called... Don't worry about the book. Okay, it's just a quote. Okay. The quote says... All men live lives of quiet desperation. Now, another more recent American writer, a guy who became president of the American Psychological Association and has started something called happiness studies, he said that most of us are desperately trying to avoid the gnawing feeling that we're just fidgeting until we die. And what a comment upon the lack of purpose amongst our community. Okay. Now it's interesting that I'll just say a little bit about what Jesus said about being lost. Three stories he tells, one after another, in the book of Luke. There's a lost sheep, a lost coin, and a lost son. Okay? Now the lost sheep gets lost. Why does a lost sheep get lost? Because it's just doing what sheep do, walking along, feet eating, and doesn't realise that it's becoming dark. It doesn't catch the last bus back to the sheepfold. Then there's a lost coin, which is a wedding coin, you know, like a dowry coin. And this woman who has this, she's got 9 others, she's lost this, and this is a significant catastrophe for her. She looks everywhere. She upturns everything. The house looks a mess by the time she's finished with it. But finally she founds it down behind this very heavy sideboard. And the coin says, listen, I'm worth so much. Look, it's right on my, you know, what do you call it? When the denomination of the coin, you know, it's $1,000 coin or whatever. And he says, listen, I'm so cranky, because I'm lost down behind this sideboard and I'm worth all this money, but in fact I'm totally useless there and it's your fault. The coin blames the woman. And then, of course, the sheep only blames God for making me a sheep. I'm just doing what sheep did. The coin blames the woman, and the lost son has no one to blame but himself. Read those stories. They're quite tragic. In Luke chapter 11. Okay, how do we get out of being lost? We need two things. We need a roadmap and a guide. So that piece of paper is going to become your roadmap. All right? Gentlemen, take your pens. And with that pen, I want you to draw a line down the middle of the page, the long axis. Okay, so that's right, turn it round. Okay, you're going to draw a line down the middle of the page. Okay, the page will never be the same again, it'll be ruined. Okay, you got the line down there, it's a rough line. And then we're going to come down and we're going to do a horizontal axis which goes across the page, all right? So these represent the two axes of life. And I want you to write on the top of the long axis, I want you to write Creator. This axis connects the Creator. Got it? Creator at the top of the page?
Top there?
Top, no, right in the middle. On the top of that line there. You can write Creator. Okay, this is that end of the axis. Okay? On the bottom you can write the planet. Just planet. So this axis connects, the vertical axis connects our Creator and the planet. Now out on the left side, on that the left arm, as you look at the page, I want you to write the word family of origin. You can just write F-O-O, foo. Just write it next to the arm, not in the square, but just write it next to the arm on the side. Write the word family of origin. You with me? On the left side. All right. And on the right side, I want you to say, write the word community. Okay. So you've got four points and two axes. The vertical axis connects the Creator and the planet. The horizontal axis connects our family of origin and our community. All right? Now this is my first take-home message. We've got to sort out our relationship with our Creator, with the planet, with our family of origin, and with our community. And if we do that, we have a balanced life, and we know where we're going. This becomes our guide. Okay, now, I'll give you two examples. A man of about 40 came into my office, really nice guy, dressed nicely in a suit, and I found out that he worked for AusAid, you know, overseas aid, Australian overseas aid. So he's really into community things, all right? He said, that's fine. He was into had quite a conservation mindset, so he's really into the planet. Then I found out that he was Jewish and that his parents had were Holocaust survivors, and they were recluses. They didn't go out to see anybody. And they turned his brother into a recluse like them. And so he was determined that he'd have nothing to do with his parents because of what they'd done. He wasn't going to be a person like that. And when it came to his Creator, he just didn't know. His Jewishness had not helped him. But he hadn't totally left it behind. There was an open question there. Okay? But at least when he looked at this map, he knew what he was doing okay and what he wasn't. Alright? And room for improvement. Another guy was an oil industry executive, came into my office, dressed in a suit again. Got nothing to do with the story, but he was an advisor to the government on the oil industry. So he's quite an influential guy. And he looked at the map and he said, well, I'm really into making the community better. That's what oil's about. I'm interested in conservation, keeping, you know, having oil industry being a positive thing and not being destructive. And my relationship with my parents is really good, but I think I'm going to have to sort out my relationship with my Creator because I don't know about that. You see how the map gave him the place where he's at and what he had to work on? All right? Okay. Now, take your pens again. Next to Creator, or just under Creator, I want you to write a number. That's the top of the page on the long axis. I want you to write the number 1. And under that, 2. And under that, 3. Okay? Now I want you to go take that and go right down to the bottom of the page. And you're going to write the number 4. Now next to family of origin, you're going to write, on the left-hand side of the page, you're going to write 5. And on the right page where it says community, I want you to write these numbers one under each other. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay. All right. Now, can anybody guess where I'm going to go with this? Good one. I love it. That's right. You can get a bonus, Mark. Cheeky thing. We're going to go to the Ten Commandments, what we know in the Bible as the Ten Commandments. Now, a Jewish friend of mine said to me the other day that all societies have 70% of these as the tenets, the major tenets of their community. The brilliance of these commands, these principles, someone says that there's only 10 of them. That's brilliant. I remember when someone said that when Bob Hawke came to power and started to, as a prime minister, within the first term he made 5,000 pieces of legislation. I mean, I bet he couldn't remember them all. But, you know, the brilliance of the Ten Commandments is that it's only 10. Okay. And in fact, the greatest teacher of all time said that these Ten Commandments were summed up by two things. One refers to the vertical axis. And it says, thou shalt love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. So this is vertical axis. So I take it to love, to appreciate, to value the most valuable person in the universe with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. Now we'll come down to four at the bottom, and with all your strength. So this axis is planted firmly in planet Earth. You could get your green pen out, if you've got a green pen, and you could just draw some grass there, because the grass is growing up around where this pole is stuck in the planet, all right? And you shall love... that's written first in the book of the Bible that's right after where it says the Ten Commandments. In the book of Deuteronomy, in the next chapter, there's two places where the Ten Commandments are in the Bible. In the book of Exodus, chapter 20, and the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 5. And in chapter 6, it says, thou shalt love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. Now remember, Jesus quoted that as something that's still existent in his time. And then the horizontal axis, you can say, love your neighbour as yourself. Okay. Now here we get the purpose of our life. The purpose of our life is to warmly value, first of all, our Creator, and secondly, our neighbour. Now, that's the purpose of life. It's not to accumulate more money. Someone asks Nelson Rockefeller, how much more money do you need, Mr. Rockefeller, or just a few million more? I went to a lecture the other day. It was actually a seminar where a friend of mine was presenting his findings of some research he'd done to a group, he's an economist, and to a group of economists at the ANU. All the heavy economists of ANU were there. All right? And they critiqued his work. And there was a guy who was the chairman of the meeting who was rather pleasant, a nice guy. And he managed the meeting really well. I thought, what a nice guy this is. And it just happened that I'd never met him before, that I had a cup of coffee out the back afterwards, and I ended up talking with him. And in our conversation, I can't remember how it came up, but he said, he's a senior economist, okay, somewhere nearer 60 than 50. He said, I haven't got a clue what the purpose of my life is. I haven't got a clue what the purpose of my life is. How's that? I reckon that's educational failure. Okay. Okay. So we're going to have a look at these these things on the these numbers, and we're going to put a letter or a word next to each one of them. And to make it simple, we're going to start off on the right-hand side with the community ones. All right? And next to 6, we're going to say murder. Next to 7, we're going to say adultery. Next to 8, we're going to say steal. Next to 9, we're going to say slander. And next to 10, we're going to say jealousy / envy. Number 6, murder. Number 7, adultery. Number 8, steal. Number 9, slander. Now, when I was young and heard these first, I thought these, you shall not do that, this, you shall not do that, and you shall not do the other, were rather stern. You know, they even felt to me profoundly negative. And then as an adult, I took up hockey, and I got a copy of the rules book. You know, it's a sort of little book that the referee has in his pocket. And I read the rules. And it said, one of the rules said, the ball shall be out when the whole of the ball is over the whole of the line. And I could hear this voice. You know, it was sort of, I thought, I've heard that voice before. Just the same as this commandment. Don't do this. The ball shall be out when the whole of the ball is over the whole of the line. And suddenly, I realized what this was all about. These were the guidelines, these rules tell you when you step out of the court. Now, you know that in tennis it's the same, but in rugby it's different. You touch the little white line with your bootlace and you're out. And unfortunately, we you know, if it's out, player who's out, we object because it's only his bootlace, ref, you know. But that's the guideline. So what I'm trying to say to you is that these commandments are the guidelines for the game. Got it? If you're out, you're out. I wasn't going to say this, but I remember the first time I ever went into an operating theatre in the hospital, the anaesthetist swung round suddenly to me and he said, "You're out!" And pointed the finger at me. "What?" He said, "You touched something. I'm supposed to be sterile and I touched something." I was disqualified. I had to go out and scrub and keep my hands up here, because otherwise I was out. It was a big thing. Okay. Now, we know what the boundaries of a football field are like, aren't we? They're white lines. They're at the end and the side, and there are goalposts up there. But none of us would pay money to go and look at goalposts or at sidelines or 80 minutes, would we? We go to see the game that's happened, the skill that's enacted right in front of us. We go and see the contest. You know, we go and see people kicking the ball or passing the ball or tackling or breaking tackles. That's what we go and see. Scoring tries. But let's take away the goalposts. Let's take away the sidelines. Someone could just pick up the ball and run. There'd be no game. Is that right? All right. So what I'm going to do is with these things, these commands, I'm going to flip them around to describe the game of life as it in these 10 aspects. All right? Okay. Their boundaries. Okay, so let's start with number 6. You will do no murder. Let's flip it around and say what it's talking about, the game of life. What are the values that it's talking about here that are worth preserving, that are worth defining? It's saying life is valuable. Life is really valuable. Life is precious. Life is worth preserving and developing. And it's saying don't destroy people. Instead, do everything in your power to build them up. Does that make sense? Do everything in your power to build people up. You know, what did the Salvation Army do? They're collecting money. No, they're not collecting money. They're actually doing, they're using money to actually do stuff for people to build them up. Isn't that right? Okay. Now, it's saying that there's an issue with us. The flip side of that is that there's an issue with us when we don't want people. I'd rather that person be dead. And, you know, we read the papers. Every day there's a new murder, isn't it? Every time you listen to the good old ABC News, there's a murder that's happened somewhere. But where did that start? And the great teacher said, if you're getting angry with a neighbour and just think in your heart that you wish to be dead, you've already crossed the boundary. You've gone out of bounds as to what is healthy human behaviour. So Jesus actually began to explain to us that it wasn't just that you kept your knife behind your back. That wasn't a good thing. You actually had to get the problem out of your heart. This hatred, this bitterness, this anger. So we're talking here about anger management. And how relevant is that to us in our society? It's really relevant, isn't it? Because we're talking about, we've got an epidemic of domestic violence. We've got an epidemic of violence, period. We have shootings. We have people who have, you know, subject of the coward punch. You know, they hit in the head, they go back, they drop their head on the ground and they smash their skull. What about the guy who was the captain of the Australian Sevens rugby team? Just a week or two before the Commonwealth Games, someone did that to him. We have a real problem of anger management. And nothing seems to be helping. Okay. Now, let's go to the seventh one. You'll not commit adultery. And I'm going to ask you the question. We're going to flip it around and I'm going to ask the question. Has ever anything been invented that goes anywhere near the thrill of sex with your complementary partner who is totally committed to you and desirous to explore the depths of intimacy with you for the rest of your life, even in old age? Is there anything been invented that goes anywhere near that? That's the game. Now this command saying, it's saying don't break it. Don't break it. Don't trash this woman. Don't speak of her badly. Don't discourage her. Give her every opportunity. And it's saying to the woman, do everything you can do to show him respect, because if you break this relationship, it's one of the worst disasters that can ever happen to you. We know that people who divorce are sadder and poorer in 5 years than if they had resolved. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that there's no reason for divorce, because Jesus clearly said that there's two reasons for divorce. One, if there's violence. And secondly, if there's adultery. Okay? Now, look, if we respected this commandment, we'd have no promiscuity. We'd not have any broken marriages and the traumatized kids. And when it comes to divorce, you know, I can't tell you the number of people who I've talked to who have had broken and lost, who will trace it back to the time when they were young and their parents were divorced. It just traumatizes them. And it sends them off balance and they hardly recover. That's why they get into addiction. The pain of loss of ideal has been terrible. Okay, if we respected this commandment, we'd have only one partner for life. Sexually transmitted diseases would go down the drain. AIDS would disappear. Depression would go down. Financial prosperity would rise. And there would be inheritances on hand when we die for our kids. Okay, this command is a masthead statement that would prevent a multitude of sexual sins and broken lives. So we've flipped it around, you know. All right. The eighth one, do not steal. Now I'm giving you your turn to describe. You see how I've flipped the other ones around from the thou shalt not to the description of the game? So what's the description of the game that's covered by this command, thou shalt not steal?
Give.
Give. Yep. Yep, give. The joy of giving. It's more blessed to give than it is to receive, isn't it? Okay, another one. Value hard work. Value effort. Yep, exactly. What else? That's a terrific one. Come on, guys. What's at the heart of stealing? Yes, it's the property that you've got, isn't it? You know, it's the stewardship of what you own and what you spend your effort and time saving up money to buy, or what somebody's given you. It's looking after it, isn't it? It's respect for the planet. Any other things? If I say respect for the planet, that's covered it at all, hasn't it? Sorry to put that one out and then ask you, is there anything more? What's that? Respect for life, yes. You can steal somebody's life, can't you? You bet they can. What about reputation? Yeah. Okay. Respect. Yep. Okay. Now remember what we were told when we were kids, and I'm not sure if this applies to you guys or not, but I think it would. When I was young, we were always taught, if you find something on the street, what do you do with it? Return it, but if you don't know who... Take it to the police station. How does that apply now? I remember that as a kid I heard a neighbour kid say, finders keepers, losers weepers. And you know what? That grated in my heart. I just felt that was offensive. I felt that was absolutely awful. Now what would happen to the security industry if you wouldn't need it, would you? You know, those people who put lights and locks on our houses, and they would have to get another job helping people. Okay. Do you know what? The nation has to have this ethic, otherwise it doesn't work. Do you know, in the Philippines, where I lived for a while, there is no street signs. Guess why? No street signs. It's not that people can't read. Yes? Oh, Eric, come on. Why are there no street signs in the Philippines? Because people steal them. People steal them. And you know what? They even steal the manhole covers on the sewer vents in the middle of the street. And I've seen a bus, the front wheel stuck down there. You know, the wheels in the thing. And I've heard of people falling into these holes. And they cost a lot to clean them up when they've fallen in there. Okay. But just imagine if we were in Japan and you lost your passport. How many have heard of people who have lost something valuable in Japan and it's been returned to them? Isn't that fantastic? It actually happened to my nephew. Lost his passport. Within the day he got it back, was at the police station. What a culture that would be. Okay. All right, don't steal. All right, we're going to go to number 9, which says, don't bear false witness against your neighbour. Don't bear false witness against your neighbour. Don't lie about your neighbour. So, let's flip this around and find out what the positive game that this boundary is trying to preserve. Any ideas? Don't talk people down. Exactly. Yep. Anything else? Lift them up. And particularly with your words. Use praise. Yes, exactly. With your words, lift people up. Don't you reckon that'd be good? Now, I want to ask you, How many of you can tell a little story in, say, three sentences that involved you in giving someone praise or complimenting them or something like that? Let me have a couple. Yes. Yep. Anyone else got another story like that?
I had a colleague in business who said, "Oh, don't make me money in business, I'm too old."
Yeah, I think we have to, it's talking about the problem of where the society's come to, isn't it? Okay, anyone else got another story about being positive? Saying things positive. I've got one. When I came to Sydney this last time, came from Sydney to Canberra, I look after my mum, who's 93, and half the week I spend there. I got in the car, I'd said goodbye to her, I'd closed the door and made sure it was locked, and a carer would come later on that afternoon. I got into the car and I'm just about to start it up, and I thought, one day it might be the last time I see her. And then I thought, I'd better go and just have a quick chat with her and tell her how much I loved her, how grateful I was for all the things she'd done for me, how much I appreciated her. And that's what I did. She was sitting down, she put her hand up and she held my cheek like this. I knew it had touched her heart. And she said, "You'll always be my firstborn. First of four kids. My mum has never, compared us in any way. We're all been treated equal. But I, somehow or other, she told me that something I never realised. It was important to her that she'd had a firstborn child. And I was there." Little things like that. We could go through the day, every day. Now, my mum lives at a beach. In Sydney, it's a very beautiful beach. And we go walking along the beach and people are walking along the beach the other way. And I feel like saying to them, and I do often, I say, "Hi, isn't it a beautiful day?" And I want to get a t-shirt that says, "Smile, you're at Palm Beach. It can't be that bad." Okay. Now, you know what positive words do. You walking along and you see someone with a dog. What do? You just compliment them on their dog. And they're just going down along there with their dog, and suddenly they're looking at you and they say, "Oh yes, it's a beautiful dog," and they tell you all about its pedigree, and they had one before, and this is the second one, because, the conversation starts, eh? What about talking to a mother of a baby in a stroller? Well, you'll become their number one fan, as you're talking to them about this beautiful little baby there. You start a community right there. I had this experience a couple of nights ago, talking to a mum with her firstborn baby. It was just lovely. Looking at this child who's looking at me and following me and smiling. And it was just a lovely moment. Complimenting the mother. Talk to the person about in the next seat. Ask them about themselves. Compliment them. Say to the lady, "That's a beautiful dress you're wearing today." My son taught me that the way you start a conversation is ask people about themselves. Where did you come from? What's your favourite thing to do? Do you like ice cream? Whatever it might be, you start off asking about themselves. Now, every now and then you'll find someone who will tell you about themselves. And they never ask you a single question about you. Well, that's just life. You get those. I remember my son met Barry Jones. Remember Barry Jones, the quiz show king and became the Minister for Education. He was too good for that, so they sent him off to become the ambassador to UNESCO. And we were at the Anzac Memorial in Villers-Bretonneux, which we've seen a lot on the TV recently in the Anzac thing. And Barry Jones was there, and he was just standing over there, and my son said to his mum, let's go and talk to Barry Jones. So I looked over about 5 minutes later, and they're laughing, and Barry Jones is slapping my wife on the back. And, you know, afterwards I talked to Dan. I said, what happened there? And he said, well, I've learned since I've been on this student exchange that the way you get people involved in conversation is to ask them about themselves. I said, what was the question you asked Barry Jones? He said, oh, I asked him, now you're the Australian ambassador to UNESCO, what do you hope to achieve? Well, those of us who remember Barry Jones will remember that he never needed two questions. He ran with us. Okay. Now, remember, it's not good enough to think complimentary thoughts about somebody. You've got to say them. You've got to thank people seven times, says a great fundraising person that I know of. My daughter is fundraising at a university in Sydney, and she began to send a lot of letters. She's part of this official fundraising program that the university is trying to get itself more better placed because governments are not funding them anymore, or not reducing funding. So she began sending letters of gratitude to donors, you know, the ones they had on their register. And somewhere, the news of this spread, and these donors started to talk to each other, and they found that they'd got a letter like this. You know, there's a lot you can research and find out about people. So my daughter would find out about them and, you know, write a letter that was like someone who actually knew them. The university knows me? Yeah. And so they found out who was sending the letters. I'll tell you a story. One of them received, an older man received one of these letters, and he burst into tears. You're off?
Thank you very
much. Oh, good. Good. Well, go and keep on complimenting them. That's great. Thank you for saying that. That's a nice thing to say. Anyway, this guy burst into tears. And then he knelt down on the ground. Now, we know nothing about this man. Well, what sort of background he has. And then it said, the message got back to my daughter. But then he knelt down on the ground in tears. And he thanked God for the privilege he had of contributing through his gift to the university. And then he wrote out a check, a multi-million dollar check, to start a new research program at the university. I asked my daughter about him the other day, and she said, oh, it's really sad. He's just died of bowel cancer. But wouldn't that be a great thing, to know that when you're gone, you've given such a gift, you know, that will be there in memorial, and it's going to help other people. I don't know. Maybe he knew he had bowel cancer and he was going to give it to a bowel cancer research institute. Lovely story. Okay, we're going to go down to the last one, C10. Are you with me? Am I going on okay? Okay, you want me to keep on going? Okay, C10, commandment number 10. Do not covet. What's the opposite of covet? What's the game that's held in by this boundary? Do not covet. What's that?
Lusting for possession.
Yeah, that's what covet is. What's the opposite? Generosity, somebody said. Peace. Yes. What sort of peace? Inner peace, yep. That's the word I'm looking for. Well done. This is the thing of contentment. Be content with the sort of person you are. You're so high, you've got blue eyes, you've got a background in such and such. Be content with what you've got. Now we'll come to the, when we, a little bit, not so long. We start off with number one, we go down like that, we come up like this, like a conductor conducting four times, okay? One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. So that number 10 takes us back in gratitude to the one who started it all off at the top, number one. All right? See how it sort of goes in a cycle? All right. So where do we go now? I think we'll go to number four, which is the bottom of the pole, the bottom of the vertical axis. This is about the rhythm of work and rest. It talks about telling us to work. It talks about telling us to have a rest every week. It talks to us about celebrating creation. What a wonderful stage for the drama of our Creator and His family. By keeping one day separate from our money, we give special honour to our Creator. Okay. Okay. Keeping one day as a Sabbath desecrates the power of money. It unlocks us from money driving us round, you know. That businessman sitting in church like this or wherever he goes on, whatever he does on Sunday, and he's so uptight, you know, he's thinking, oh, I've got to write those checks, I've got to ring up, I've got to put that proposal in, you know, I've got to check out the new manager that we got in because we don't think he's any good. Stop! At least one day a week. It desecrates the power of money. Okay, it's a day for doing good for others. Now, a non-Sabbath-keeping country is an uptight country. I remember being in the Philippines, as I said, I lived there for a while. And I went to the mall on a Sunday. In those days, there wasn't Sunday trading in Australia. And I noticed how uptight this community was. Absolutely uptight. And I thought to myself, you know, that's going to come to Australia. It did. In 1986, Sunday trading became in Australia. This community doesn't have time to reflect anymore. They've got to keep on being driven by the fierce hand of mammon. Stress goes up, we lose direction, we lose priority. Okay, it's really important. Changes. You know, changes society when we've got a day of rest and we go around to see our neighbours or we go around to see our family. It just means that family is important. It tells us a lot of things about that we're using our money, using our effort. It's not using us. Okay, let's come to number five. Honour your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land that Lord your God gives you. This is the first command with a promise. It says, if you obey this, you'll live long lives. The community will be healthy. It's absolutely true that this is the commandment that keeps a community intact. Okay. Now, it says honour. What is honouring? Well, I want to give you I've got a handout here. Someone can bring that down. This tells us what honour is, but it starts off with what honour isn't. Honour doesn't mean to love. It doesn't mean to like. It doesn't mean to think that the other person does everything right. Thanks. It doesn't mean to think to agree with them. It doesn't mean to obey them. It doesn't mean to put a positive spin on all their bad behaviour. Alright? So, you can look at that. But what is honouring? Honouring, as far as I can see, is three things. Honouring is being grateful. Giving thanks. Secondly, honour is respect. And remember, as I said, we have to give thanks. We have to say it, not just think it. Okay? Honour is respect, which is an attitude which leads to action. How we speak about our parents. Honouring is also keeping the parents in the loop. You know what I mean by that? Keeping them informed as to your progress. You know, most of us have been old enough, and I presume quite a few of us have children and grandchildren. And what a joy it is to see our kids' progress, see our grandkids' progress. But what about the kid? You ask him, how'd your day go at school? Right. What'd you do today? Oh, nothing. Yeah, were you happy today? No. How many of us have experienced or seen kids like that? Okay. This is a tragedy. Tragedy. As adults, our parents delight in our progress, even when we're adults. As a child, we need to be taught how to keep our parents in the loop. Now, if I was God saving the problem of families, would I talk to the parents or would I talk to the children? First. If you were God saving, you know, addressing the problem of families in our society, would you talk to the parents first or the children first? Did I hear parents? That's right. Well, why does God speak to the children first? He says, honour your father and your mother. He's talking to the kids. Okay. You know, if we haven't honoured our parents, how can we teach our children to do it? And even as adults, if we haven't been particularly honouring of our parents, we've got a great opportunity to start that now. The way we treat our parents is the pattern of adult relationships that we're going to establish for the rest of our life. When we're an adult, we will treat other adults like we treated our parents. Now, none of us has perfect parents, so we all have an excuse for not engaging with them, right? Nobody can say, I'm not going to join the end. Now, when we talk to the parents, we're also talking to the kids. Now, by listening to our kids, talking about their stuff, we are giving them an ability to find their voice. Find their voice. It's incredibly important that we talk to our kids and we engage them and we teach them to talk back to us. You know, finding one's voice is the greatest protection that we have in the world against bullies. We give them the experience to be able to talk about the thing that's most difficult, the most difficult thoughts and experiences we have. Now this week, I stayed overnight with my daughter and son-in-law, and they told me this story about their four-year-old child in preschool. Husband, father, is washing the kid in the bath, and he notices he's got a thick lip, and that his speech is not that good, and that he's sore around the face. He asks, what happened? What happened today? And the little kid reluctantly tells this story of, at preschool, he and another boy are told that they had to lie down on the mat. You know, there's a mat, two people there, two people there, two people there. And they're to be quiet because this is nap time. But the other boy actually attacked my grandson and belted him up. And my daughter heard about this and she's mortified. I have talked to the kids. When you're uncomfortable, talk to a parent. When something's wrong, tell an adult. And that's what she said to him. And he said back, he said, but the teacher said that at this time, we're not supposed to talk. He was trying to be, you know, a good kid. But what an opportunity to tell this kid that when danger happens, that becomes the priority. And I say about confidentiality. Confidentiality finishes when danger begins. Okay? What an opportunity. Okay? And My parents, my daughter and her son, are giving this little child permission to say what he is really thinking and to handle a very difficult emotional situation. They are giving this little kid their voice, his voice, in bad situations. Okay. Now, most teenagers will tell you, if you ask them, that they don't think their parents understand them. Now, of course, they understand the parents. Now, it's really sad that if a child has got to that point, he's already going down the negative path. It's sad that at that point they must have had experiences of not feeling heard by their parents already. Okay? So as parents, we actually need to give our children a way to honour us. First by listening to them, giving them the experience of being listened to. Now, I want to give you some really hot tips, okay? Three most important words in the English language. You'll never get them. You'll never guess them. So, you know, it's too many words in English. But you'll never get them. These are the three most important words in the English language. The first one is, oh. 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 What am I doing? Going into their world. Beautiful. I would never have thought to put it in those words. That's great. Yes?
You're listening.
You're listening. And you're also encouraging them. The listening's not finished. You know, I've got to make the dinner now. Sorry, I can't talk to you anymore. It's not anything like that, is it? Oh, you're inviting to come back, aren't you? Okay. Here's another really good English word. It's the word uncomfortable. It is never a crime to be uncomfortable. You can't. It's not a hanging offence. And it's good to recognise what feeling uncomfortable is like. And this is what my daughter says to her little son. Whenever you feel uncomfortable, go and talk to someone. Being uncomfortable is something that we have the right to be, and to be able to say it, to be able to verbalise it. So that we're teaching this little boy that not only can he understand the word uncomfortable, but he can verbalise it. And he's got to find a position, a place where he can. Okay, and this whole process is the third word, which is called attending. In a psychological sense, you know, if I'm talking to Steve and I'm talking to you, I'm attending to you, you know. Do you understand what I'm saying there? Attending? It's a great word. And we're to do this. We're to attend to other people. Okay. Now, who would have thought that in this fifth commandment, all this wealth of experience of human development would have been enshrined just in the commandment, honour your father and your mother. Okay. Now, it's a really sad thing that the world systems do not understand this. They don't understand that the most primal relationship we have is with our parents. I first began to realise how different they thought about parent-child relationships when I did some pediatrics and pediatric psychology, and they always tried to get the parents out of the room. They wouldn't talk to them. In fact, now we have a situation where the government may sponsor taking kids away from their parents. Of course, when the kid becomes, you know, an absolute rat bag, they give them back to their parents because they realise that they've failed. The practice is here now that if your child or grandchild may express any thought of wanting to be the opposite sex or be taken to be that, like, oh, that's a lovely, says a lovely thing to another little, a boy says a thing to a little girl, that's a pretty dress you've got on. Oh, I wish I had a dress like that. Some well-meaning school authority may refer this to a counsellor who could put that person into a program that would groom them to have a sex change. And the process would conspire you as a parent or a grandparent to be never alerted to that fact that this kid, yours or your grandchild, is actually being mentored to have a sex change in a public school. And you would be kept totally in the dark. This would be under the watchful eye of an employee of the school dedicated as a gender equity officer. And any teacher that did not report such an innocent statement from a child may be found liable. It's frightening, isn't it? Okay. Let's get back to C1, 2, and 3, the commands at the top of the list. Now, is anybody going to forget this morning? Is anybody going to see the commandments as different to what they saw of it before? How this was the goal of life. This tells you where your life can go. This is the guide. I want to say something about future, and particularly the future for young people. I often say to people, I know exactly what your future vocation is. And people think, you know, people go through the whole of high school and they have no clue as to what their future vocation is. That's a failure of education, isn't it? Okay, I'm not going to be too critical. So I'm putting myself up as someone who's going to tell this kid what his vocation is, or her vocation. Now listen to me, this is your vocation. Where it happens, where your great passions and the world's great needs come together. Your vocation is where your great passions and the world's great needs come together. Now look, I've been a little bit naughty with you people. I noticed some people writing this stuff down. But I've already written it down for you. You've got a cross diagram yourself. I think I've got 25 there. That's exactly why you're doing it. You're engaged more, you know. Oh, another thing for the bin. No. Okay. Now, this is talking... What's that? It is. And to push them up. I never forget a school teacher at school. I don't know why I was in this public swimming pool when they're having a school swimming carnival. And this teacher, and this little kid, he must have been, you know, high school, but he's only that tall. He must have been the smallest kid in the school. It just happened to be that this teacher looked like he was the smallest teacher in the school too. And this teacher going, Now, if that's not a really positive education experience, is it? This teacher was really blasting into this little kid. You know, I made a big mistake. If I had that again, I would walk over to that teacher and I'd engage him. And I'd try to get between me and that child. Because that wasn't a very positive educational experience. Okay. Now, we're going back to C1, 2 and 3. These three things you haven't written anything besides C1, 2 and 3, have you? Let's write on the top one, Father, on the second one, Son, and the third one, Holy Spirit. And that's actually not on the handout, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Okay. Benjamin Netanyahu, did I mention that earlier, said that these values that we see here are the values that are the basis of Western civilization, of civilization itself. And they come from the Creator and the biblical creation story. And there are remnants of this story in every culture, except what I call the cultures of the Great Deceptions. There's a beautiful book entitled Eternity in Their Hearts by a guy by the name of Don Richardson who traces the story of the remnants of the creation story in every culture. This line goes from Jewish culture with Abraham and Moses and extends through Jesus and his founding people who changed and his founding of the people who changed the world in his name. These values are the values that make our society what it is. And the top value in society is, Hear, O Israel, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. I am, I do. And what I do is I set people free from bondage. That's what God says he is. And it's, talk a little bit about the cross thing here, the cross axis, the human axis. Thomas Jefferson in the US Declaration of Independence says, we hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men are created, men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Unalienable, that's right. And among these, a life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, I wouldn't have written that. I wasn't around there to advise Jefferson. But I certainly would have said life, liberty, and I would say the opportunity to be fully formed as the person you're destined to be. Unfortunately, pursuit of happiness is an illusion. Happiness is a byproduct of doing the stuff that we're talking today, loving God and loving your neighbour. Happiness will come. If we chase it as a primary goal, it's like a mirage. It just gets further and further away. It's that like that line at the Olympic swimming carnivals, where you see the world record mark, you know, and the swimmers swimming up to it, and it's just getting further and further away. That's what happiness is like. Yeah. There is only one God, and he says this. Now search all of history, from the time God created people on the earth until now, and search from one end of heavens to the other. Has anything as great as this ever been seen or heard before? Has any nation ever heard the voice of God speaking from the fire as you did and survived? Has any other God dared to take a nation from himself out of another nation by means of trials, miraculous signs, wonders, war, strong hand and powerful arm and terrifying acts? Yet that is what the Lord your God did for you in bringing you out of Egypt, right before your eyes. He showed you these things so that you would know that the Lord is one God and there is no other. He let you hear his voice from heaven so he could instruct you, and let you see his great fire here on earth so he could speak to you from it. Because he loved your ancestors, he chose to bless their descendants, and he personally brought you out of Egypt with a great display of power. He drove out nations far greater than you so he could bring you in and give you their land as a special possession. So remember, keep this firmly in mind. The Lord is God both in heaven and earth, and there is no other. If you obey all the decrees and commandments I am giving you today, all will be well with you and your children. I am giving you these instructions so that you will enjoy a long life in the land your God is giving you for all time. Pretty strong, isn't it? Strong. Let's go on to C2. Now, this commandment directly refers to the second person of the threeness. Threeness is the word that St. Patrick used back in 400 AD. He referred to the Trinity as the threeness. You must not make for yourself an idol of any kind or an image of anything in the heavens and the earth. You must not bow down to images. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God who will not tolerate your affections for other gods. I lay the sins of parents upon their children. The entire family is affected, and even children to the third or fourth generations of those who reject me. But I lavish unfailing love for thousands of generations for those who love me and keep my commandments. Why do I know this is about Jesus? Because it says in the New Testament that Jesus is the visible image of the invisible God. He existed before anything was created and is supreme over all creation. For through him, God created everything in the heavenly realms and on earth, and he made the things we can see. Everything was created through him and for him. He existed before anything else, and he holds all creation together. He is the image of the Father, the perfect image. And that's one of the things about being human and being made in the image of God, that God can actually bring his character into us without it being diminished. Okay. The Son of God radiates God's own glory and expresses the very character of God, and he sustains everything by the power of his mighty hand. Okay, we're going to go on to the last one here. This is C3. I go to a church called C3. I'd love to preach there, but I'd preach about C1, C2, C3, Z4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Anyway, that's a joke. You must not misuse the name of the Lord your God. And what is the image? What is the name? In ancient languages, the word, the name, reflected the character. Okay? So this is the character of the Holy Spirit, the third person of the Trinity. Okay? He is the one who forms the very nature of God in our lives when we invite him to. But if we do not listen to this, his voice, we end up shipwrecked. He's the God. He's part of God that's on the planet. He comes into our being and forms the character of God in our lives. He is a creator constantly speaking to our inward being. Now I want to ask you this question. This will probably be almost my last question. Can you remember, this is one that we all need to answer ourselves. There are moments in our lives when we heard the still small voice of God. Now, I want to put it to you that I think this is universal to every person on the planet, that the Holy Spirit speaks to every one of them. Can you think of a time? I just wonder if you put up your hand. I don't want to ask you what it was all about. Did you ever have a situation where you heard the voice of God speak to you? We may not have recognized it. It's often in our conscience. That's not the voice of God, Andrew. Well, it could be. Okay, that's Andrew's being rung by a friend of ours, and he's being asked, why is he at the men's shed this morning? Okay. How many people have heard that? Yeah. How many think they might have? I'll just give you a little idea. Do you ever get into a situation when you were totally out of control? Was there some sort of awareness there that you've been preserved? Okay. Well, I can remember being on my first horse ride, the horse bolted at a gallop. I remember coming off a motorcycle. What about when, at the birth of your first child? Remember seeing that little child and this was sort of like a holy moment. Looked at this little kid and said, I didn't do anything. Even the mum would say that. She said, I was just the house where this little child was growing. What we saw was a gift, and there was this sort of speaking in our hearts of being a holy moment. Speaking in our hearts of it, this being a holy moment.
Yeah, it's getting a little quiet.
Thank you. I've got a bad habit of that. Okay. What about a sudden lucid moment in nature, or an awesome sight in nature? Just to see these huge waves at a beach, or you know, something that's being out in a storm, and you think, "Wow, this is big." A sudden lucid moment. I remember seeing my grandmother dying. I was the last person saw her. This lovely woman dying. It was a lucid moment. In our conscience, God often speaks. And in one of those, it's like a conversation where everything stands still. I encourage you to listen, to go back and think about the times where it might have been saying, that was a stupid thing to do, wasn't it? Okay. What is the greatest value in the universe? The greatest value in the universe is God himself. I think I said that. Well, what's God like? He's not tyrannical. In fact, he must be a Trinity. Because you can't have love without someone to love and someone to receive love and someone to witness it. God's not a bully. He's predictable. He's ordered. He's self-control, and he delights in us. If we reject the path of life, we end up desecrating life itself. Now, has anybody, this is what I'm going to conclude with, has anybody, you probably say, listen, do you know what the definition of an optimist is? He's a person who believes a preacher when he says, finally. How's that? Okay. What about the story of Waltzing Matilda? This is at the right in the very... This is really close to us, isn't it? How many people love the tune? I love the tune. It's just beautiful. I love the setting. You know, by a billabong. That's where we'd love to be, wouldn't it be? You know, if that's where we could finish up our life, we'd be happy. I love the sense of... But this guy, all was right with the world until the squatter and the troopers turn up. And then this guy is betrayed. The swagman who has gone so far to get away from it all. You know, he may have been a convict who had been done his time, sent out to England, from England. But there's something deep inside of him that's not right. And he's prepared to say, I'm not going to let anybody control me. I'm even going to forfeit my life to prove that. What a tragedy. Sorry, I'm going to even forfeit my life to prove that. That's a total tragedy. This is a guy who never found the guidelines. Has been running all his life. We find if we neglect these guidelines of life, we're in bondage to a much more oppressive master. Our own lusts, our own fears, our own selfishness, and our own politics of hate and oppression. I commend to you that you read them. These commandments. I'm going to ask you how well you listened today. This is the exam, okay. You can. What's the first commandment? Lord your God, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. I am the Lord your God, the one who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. What's number two? Nope. Number two? No? Oh, that's right. If we get the two summary ones, it's to love God with all our heart, to love our neighbours as ourselves. But we'll go through the number 1 to 10. Okay, what's number 1? Yeah, no idols. No fake images of God. Number 3? No, the image is number 2. Number 3? The character former. Do not neglect the voice of the Holy Spirit speaking to our hearts. Number 4. No. You're one ahead of yourself. That's 5. That's right. Good. Yep. Yeah, it's the one about Sabbath, isn't it? Yeah. It's the balance. It's the rhythm of work and rest. Okay. Number 5, you said, is honour your father and your mother. Number 6, just the word. Murder. Number 7, no adulteries. Okay, they're actually an interesting priority there. Number 7 is steal. No, sorry, 8 is steal. Number 9, slander. And number 10, covet. And the flip side of that is to be content. Yeah. Okay. I hope we get so familiar with these that we can rattle them off. But I hope we get so familiar that we do them. And that this becomes our watchword for our life. That we get up in the morning and say, this is my opportunity today to love God with all my heart and to love my neighbour as myself. Okay. Thank you for being patient with me. Thanks for writing down stuff. I hope this is something, a talk today that has like a Lincoln required, asked us to do something great.